I just wanted to attend Connie Corleone's wedding. In honor of Love Lies Bleeding, in theaters this weekend, what's the worst cinematic way to get pulled into a life of crime or espionage?
I'm Katie Rich, and I have not seen the movie Argyle, but I feel like that cat in the backpack didn't deserve anything that happened to him over the course of Argyle. You guys can tell me if I'm reading this wrong.
I'm Matt Patches, and I did not prep for this question, so I'm coming up
I'm not coming up short.
I'm actually coming up with Baby's Day Out, because I feel like that baby is committing a lot of crimes, and they didn't ask for that. Just close your windows. Don't let him escape out crawl along I-beams and such in a big city.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven, and imagine being a stoner just trying to get by when Connie Britton utters some Max Landis written code words into your ear, and suddenly you're in American Ultra.
You remember that movie?
Oh, wait, I thought the question was like, what was the worst act of espionage in a movie?
The worst cinematic way to get pulled into a life of crime.
Yeah. Because
Love Lies Bleeding.
Into a life of crime.
Is about a bodybuilder who falls in love with the gym owner. And that gym owner is secretly part of a crime family. So she gets pulled into crime.
Oh, the worst way to be pulled into...
Yeah, you don't want to be pulled into crime.
You can just say attending Connie Corleone's wedding.
You could. That was right there in the title.
I mean, but that's a pretty good way, I think.
Yeah, sure. That wedding looks pretty fun.
You're in The Godfather. That's exciting.
Yeah.
The worst way...
What if it's having a tune walk into your office and hire you to solve crime?
Again, these are
that's
like famously good movies. And that would
what
rule.
What about Sandra Bullock receiving a backdoor code for government operations?
Sandra Bullock sounds like a character from Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, she is. She gets the EXE on her disc, and then the net happens because she's
she's not committing crime.
No, she's pulled into a life of crime. Right, she's being pulled into the hero.
Sandra, I think if you're pulled into a life of crime, you're then committing crime.
I'll go with
Cherry, David.
I'll go with Cherry. That's a great answer. Oh, and there's a baby screaming because I mentioned Cherry.
No one likes to talk about Cherry. Give your answer. Give your answer.
What? Cherry?
You gave your answer? Oh,
I mean, Cherry is a great answer, and it's got to be one of the 10 worst films I've seen in the last 10 years, at least of the films I've written about. I mean, truly, I think about this often. It is in the running.
Cherry.
See, that's one of the ones I watched in the pandemic and doesn't exist.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 466. It is the week of Wednesday, March 12th. That is forever to me the day after the pandemic started. Happy 4-year anniversary of the pandemic, everybody.
Wow. Wait, why?
Because March 11th is the Tom Hanks and NBA day. So March 12th is the first day that we were in the shit. Then March 13th, I think, is the day that that school closed.
What?
Happy anniversary to that. Yeah,
happy
great.
Anniversary to that fun time that we podcasted through. It's also the day that in 1894, Coca-Cola was sold in bottles for the first time in a candy store in Vicksburg, Mississippi.
What was it sold in before?
It was like a fountain thing.
Yeah,
like you would get it from the soda jerk.
Oh, you would put the syrup in the... Okay.
Yeah, like this is the first time you could get it from the cooler outside
the
gas station.
They say it tastes better than the bottle.
Or whatever.
Oh, that's because it has a normalized syrup. Then in a can. Oh, I don't know about that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, it definitely tastes better from a fountain than in a bottle.
I imagine it switches. So like in 1894, I imagine Coca-Cola tastes better in a bottle because who's mixing
sodas
correctly?
Because the people who were mixing them didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah, yeah, they're like, it's not white anymore. That must mean that's enough mix. But now these days.
You needed automation. You needed the Baja Blast machine to properly mix your fountain drink.
Yeah, that's my guess. Awesome. To really be bootlickery about it, Coca-Cola has the authentic formula, which is only available if Coca-Cola bottles it.
Have you guys been to the Coca-Cola factory?
In Atlanta, the museum? Yeah. Yeah. Do they still let you taste all the different Cokes from around the world?
They do. And that's what I'm thinking of, because it's all fountain operated. Like, you can mix and match. It's very flavorful.
Yeah.
Good experience.
I got to take my kids there someday.
What museum's based on junk food?
Yeah.
Sure.
Not a lot of them. I've been to the Ben and Jerry's factory.
That's a factory. That's a good one.
Experience. Been to the Coca-Cola Museum. No Taco Bell.
I'm not sure.
There's like the Museum of Ice Cream, the whole Instagram concept thing.
I would love a tour of Taco Bell's fucking food experimentation room where they come up with all the new shit.
The R&D.
Yeah.
Now that's like Willy Wonka. Like you got to sign a big old NDA before they're gonna let you.
I've seen some videos of it, and I'm like, how did you get in? Because it's always like fucking Conan O'Brien or something. I'm like, they're not gonna let me in, but I would go.
Willy Wonka factory for Taco Bell, where it's nacho cheese flowing through rivers and crunch wrap. Flowers.
You could definitely just like eat one piece of candy and it tastes like a full Taco Bell meal.
That'd be pretty sweet.
And then your stomach feels
like the dream. We're not making anyone vomit.
Should we explain that David was on the lightning round question, but we'll be back at some undetermined point later?
We assume he's
going to
be
on
the lightning round question. At this point,
that's
we started
true.
Recording the podcast, assuming David is going to join the podcast
Talk
later.
Talk about
on.
A glimpse behind the R&D behind
this
the
is
scenes.
Kind of a Tenant like episode. We're moving forward and backward in time. We're not sure what just happened.
This is the Willy Wonka's behind the scenes tour of podcasting. But speaking of behind the scenes, we have reviews.
Yeah, we got one review on the American Apple Podcasts app. This one comes from Shazara. It is 5 stars and it is titled, quote, "I'm very susceptible to sex stares this week," unquote. "I've been listening for years and just needed the right review title to actually get me to write this. Thanks, Dave." Oh, I was talking about the popcorn bucket. "I know this will probably encourage the wrong behavior, but I kind of like all the background noise that various mics, David's, pick up. It's immersive."
David's?
"Anyways, y'all rule, never change." So that's our app review. You could definitely...
Great.
Leave
they
it.
Love the background noise of
they
the
do.
Podcast.
Yeah, that's not the foreground noise. Less of that, more background noise.
Turn down the talk and get me more tap, tap, tap and munching on food in between conversations.
Suddenly Asa showing up.
If I could just hear the Marvel Snap being played when I'm not listening to the other people talk, that'd be great.
And we got one email to fitwr.podcast@gmail.com. This one is, the subject is parenting YouTube kids, and they ask I don't use their name, which is fine. It's kind of a long one. Here we go. "I've been waiting for when Screen Time / Kids Media would come up on the show, as I'm in a similar era of parenting to Patches and Katie. I think although a lot of media seems new and formidable, algorithms, user-generated content, constant availability, the messaging really hasn't changed. Poverty porn, exploitation of marginalized communities, teaser hypercut intros, all of that isn't new. It used to be the intro to an hour-long TV special, or in a Sarah McLachlan-accompanied SPCA ads, or if you got really lucky, Aphex Twins accompanied St. Jude's ads. And now it's Mr. Beast. I'm not exactly a Mr. Beast fan, but I would argue that Mr. Beast building wells is perhaps better than insidious religious organizations exploiting poverty in the global south to profit and spread their religion. I do want to push on the idea that adults need to be engaging kids outside of screens, as if that will somehow offset what they see on the screens or need to be competing with screens. YouTube, Roblox, Twitch streamers, etc. will continue to exist and evolve in ways we can't predict, and they're not the enemy of school plays, playing outside, or anything else done off screen. They aren't mutually exclusive. Much as Katie proved in the following segment, which, to remind viewers, was talking about Zelda in the car, screens and gaming can and should be something that comes up naturally in conversation, so they could be ways of bonding and connecting instead of ways of pulling us into a power struggle. Regarding YouTube algorithm woes, I empathize, and this is a major reason why we avoid generated content platforms. That said, although Patches is very correct that kids can evade roadblocks put in place by adults, YouTube is actually really flexible and has robust parental controls. Within YouTube, you could set up a monitored account that looks like regular YouTube, but could have anywhere from no restrictions to whitelisted only content, and it could connect with Google Family Link to show you all of your child's browser use on the Chromebook, if you want to go in that direction. In my family, we allow YouTube kids on a tablet set to approve content only. I approve channels that I know are in alignment with our family values. No Blippi, no Mr. Beast, Yes, Studson Studios, who makes things from video games and movies out of trash. Anyway, yeah, ultimately they can work around these things, but putting those limits in place at least controls what we can control. Kids can always remove their helmet when they bike away from our house, but we still insist on them being worn to begin with, if that analogy makes sense. Good luck in your parenting endeavors. This shit is hard and you're all doing great.
That is it.
That was a great email.
Great email.
This is no telling notes. Me I need to do the work and find Zelda related YouTube content that I know is not offensive because
yeah, that will take work because there's probably a lot of
the idea of like whitelisting all these YouTube channels is daunting to consider. But yeah, like my kids are not like dying to watch YouTube, so it hasn't been a big problem, but
why aren't you watching the Polygon YouTube channel where we do amazing videos about bridge making in Tears of the Kingdom?
Well, when we get to Tears of the Kingdom, what we do.
My thought was also Godzilla and Tears of the Kingdom, one of the greatest Zelda videos of all time, but that is just going to spoil Katie's kids. They're going to be like, why can't I do that?
Yeah. We need nothing but Breath of the Wild videos at this point. But I will say the Zelda thing, which now people have kind of heard how we talk about Zelda in our house. Like, I know that a lot of parents like cannot get on board with Minecraft or Roblox, and I get that. But like the fact that all of us are literate in Zelda and have been playing it to some extent has been incredible. Like, it makes a big difference in being able to kind of clock into what they're talking about. And again, it's a time commitment. It's like I am doing Zelda with my leisure time that I would otherwise be using for other stuff. But I've been really glad we did it. So I hope that everyone can at least find one thing that they can clock into along with their kids and all discuss because it's fun.
Yeah. And for those of us that don't have kids, enjoy last week's Katie making me relive how to get into the Yiga clan hideout. That was, I was like, can I edit this down? I'm like, no, this is pertinent information on how to get into the Yiga clan hideout. So
I would like everyone to know that since we recorded that, I have defeated Va Meadow. Actually, no, had I already done Va Meadow when we recorded that? I can't remember.
You didn't ask them about that, so I couldn't tell if you were working on it or they had
I was working on Va Meadow, and then we also just got to, not Vonnegut, the one on the volcano.
Varudania.
Varudania. That's the last one I got. It was a good time.
Yeah. You too can share your thoughts either on the Apple Podcast app, where we will read anything that's in the American store, or email us at fitwr.podcast@gmail.com. If not, someone's going to talk about a mobile game, and don't think just because David's late, we're not going to step up to that task. It's the dream.
Well, Dave, you have the Dune popcorn bucket, which is the true viral popcorn bucket. Hopefully the only viral popcorn bucket of the year. Like, I kind of shudder to imagine what's going to happen after this.
There's an Ecto-1 popcorn bucket that Lowe's is doing for Ghostbusters. So this might just be the summer of weird-ass popcorn buckets.
I mean, it makes sense on some level. But did you know that there's a Kung Fu Panda 4 popcorn bowl that now lives in my house?
Ooh, no.
It's a bowl. It's like a medium-sized salad bowl. Like, you could imagine yourself like putting Halloween candy
in it
by the door.
Got at the theater when you
got at the theater.
Film.
It's like it's not like the Dune thing where it like keeps everything inside. Like, it's very wide, so you have to carry it very carefully.
It's like
it
a mom sits in the middle and holds the bowl in her lap. Bowl.
Basically, and it comes with three little figurines that like have like little arms that kind of clasp onto the side of Poe and Mr. Ping, his goose father, and Zhen, the new character voice by who is a fox. So we have the three of them, and they're a strong fixture in our house.
The animal like she portrays as a fox.
No, we're not talking about a Robin Hood movie situation.
Here's things we should set as baselines right now.
Okay.
We're talking about a fox, we're talking about an actual fox.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I also am going to forget her name. So if we say the Awkwafina fox, that is a character in the movie voiced by Awkwafina.
She's the only fox in the movie, I think. There's like other animals, but I don't think there's another fox.
But you're not referring to it as a sexy fox.
No, not the vibe here. But this has all happened because my kids have become obsessed with Kung Fu Panda. Because of this new movie, like, we started watching the old ones because they had never really seen them. I think the last one came out in 2016. Which is the year my older child was born. So it's just been a while. So we went on a Kung Fu Panda binge. And so Kung Fu Panda 4 was a major event. And if you ask Sam, the younger one, it is the best of the series. Ooh. I would disagree. His teacher was asking me about this. She seemed very skeptical.
I would be shocked.
And I said, it's fine. Like, I think when you've got a franchise of movies that are like operating on some high level, and then a TV series also that's kind of like a couple steps below, which is how Kung Fu Panda's been operating, Kung Fu Panda 4 can kind of slide comfortably in the middle, like below the tier of the first three movies, but above the tier of the TV show, and get away with it and make some money, which seems like exactly their strategy. They kind of did the bare minimum, and it's fine. I have not like.
Wow, no cutting strong film criticism on the podcast.
There's nothing it's in fine. It that's like very like, oh my God, I can't believe we're doing this. Like the Kung Fu Panda series has always been like silly. Like it's not there's anything like too
well,
goofy
I would,
that would okay.
Let me I have not seen Kung Fu Panda 4. Didn't as I was mentioning off podcast, it didn't rain enough for me to cross that echelon of going and taking my kid. We had to play outside. I am a big fan, as I think we established last week when we were talking about the DreamWorks achievements, the canon. I'm a big fan of Kung Fu Panda 2 and kind of 3. Like Kung Fu Panda 1 gets off to a solid DreamWorks grading on a curve start, I think, that it's like big, fun action movie, Jack Black, Jack Chan, like we're doing a throwback.
Angelina Jolie's Tigress.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Seth Rogen is a Praying Mantis, I think.
David Cross is a crane.
Reaches a totally different level. I fell really hard in love with this movie. And the director, Jennifer Yu Nelson, who I just thought was like, this was a big action movie. Kung Fu Panda 2 is using 3D, using 2D. It's full of stylization. The action scenes are up there with like Mad Max, Fury Road. Like, I really think Kung Fu Panda 2 is operating on such a different level than almost any animated action movie ever, to the point where I'm like, why isn't this woman getting the Brad Bird treatment? Like, why does Brad Bird go get to make what was his
Incredibles 2
Tomorrowland?
Tomorrowland.
Okay,
why
wait,
do we want
that.
Jennifer Yu Nelson to make Tomorrowland?
No, but like just jumping, or Andrew Stanton getting to do John Carter. Let me think of a better version. Brad Bird got to make Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol.
Right,
shut up
right,
about
right,
Tomorrowland.
That is your example.
We're talking
I'm
about a good leap here and making a big action movie with Tom Cruise. Jennifer Yu Nelson should have been making big action movies with Tom Cruise. She made
trash
a YA movie with
a sci-fi
movie. No, that didn't go well. But you really have to look at like Kung Fu Panda 2 as this really high bar. So that's why I was curious for 4, and as you said, there hasn't been just one television show with Kung Fu Panda. Like, this is a great comedic character. He can flop around and be silly in lots of little adventures. I think there's been 3 television shows. I think there was a Nickelodeon one, a Netflix one, and an Amazon one. Like, a lot of Kung Fu Panda content, and nothing that's going to eclipse Kung Fu Panda 2. But I do think each movie has been an opportunity to kind of challenge how DreamWorks makes movies, not maybe not in the Puss in Boots Last Wish level of completely restylizing how they even tell their stories.
Great
but,
movie.
I wondered if Kung Fu Panda 4, having been like just ground down by the content mill, still had like flourishes of great animation, even if the story is trite and we haven't even talked about like what it's about and maybe it doesn't matter. I know that Viola Davis is in it playing
Viola Davis
a shapeshifter
is the chameleon
something?
A chameleon literally.
Yes.
I saw a picture of her character like mimicking Poe.
Mm-hmm.
And like, do people think that does she imitate Poe, and like do people think that she's actually Poe at
you know,
any point?
No. You would think that's what happens with the shapeshifter plot, but Kung Fu Panda 4 is not doing that.
I would say that's a relief because she has glowing eyes and evil faces.
Yeah,
like, there's no mistaking her.
There is a little bit of a giveaway.
Poe.
There is one scene where you kind of meet her for the first time and she's with a table full of mob bosses and she pretends to be one of them. But
that's
the only time, I think.
There's a real disconnect in Kung Fu Panda 4 between like its A plot and its B plot. And so, like, warning signs while I was watching Kung Fu Panda 4 that maybe things weren't getting better. Right at the beginning, they're like, Furious 5, off, do other things. Those other things sound interesting. But we're not gonna watch any of it.
No voices of any expensive actors who may have signed a 3-film contract with DreamWorks are present in this movie.
Except Dustin Hoffman.
Dustin Hoffman's there. Seth Rogen does giggle and therefore get credited as Seth Rogen. Yes.
Really?
In the credits sequence.
Wow. I hope Seth Rogen got paid $20 million for that.
Yeah. But instead, now Poe has to take over for Master Yugwe, who has passed and is fighting the chameleon, who is pulling Kung Fu Masters out of the spirit world and sucking their powers. So, like the bull in Kung Fu Panda 3, this is Kung Fu Panda 3.5 in terms of, but instead of Shifu retiring, it's Yugwe obviously not being there, and Po needs to ascend to there, therefore picking another dragon warrior. He gets sidetracked by Fox Thief Awkwafina, who then team up because she knows the location of the chameleon. For reasons that, Katie, I'm guessing your kids didn't guess, but I certainly guessed what was going to happen when she...
Awkwafina was being like, some locals raised me, and we're not going to worry about who that was or what my connection to the main villain of the plot is. Yes, I did catch that.
Yes.
And I was not paying the most attention to Kung Fu Panda 4, I'm going to admit.
The other thing is a B-plot, which feels like a series of what I would imagine would make good television content, which is what happens if Poe's two fathers follow him like a day behind wherever he's been. And somehow after like the first 20 minutes of this movie, where, the chameleon's in disguise and there's this mysterious person, and Fox Awkwafina knows it's the chameleon, and that seems like important information that maybe only she has. We then cut to Mr. Ping and Lee Shan, who are like, there's a shape-shifting sorceress after our son. We better go help him. And I'm like, first of all, how do you know? Second of all, you don't have to go help him. He's the dragon warrior, which they do address that part. And, father's love can't be replaced. Two fathers, great. But that's our B-plot. Our B-plot is, let's see what happens when the dads get there, and if anything interesting to them happens, if, a character falls when they're not supposed to fall, or if a goose character doesn't know how to speak underworld, which is fine, but doesn't feel like essential to the movie or something that needed to be, especially when other Kung Fu Panda media exists out there, necessarily part of Kung Fu Panda 4. I would have loved, instead of all that B-plot with the fathers, we got like one scene each of the Furious Five doing whatever the fuck they were doing. Because
they would have had to pay for them.
Yeah, well, I'm glad they saved some money, I guess, but it does devalue the specialness of a theatrical release Kung Fu Panda.
Favorite Kung Fu Panda movie, according to
critics. Here's the thing. All the animation still looks really good.
Well, that's what I want to know. Is it like still stylized? Do they do like cool 2D sequences in this movie?
I got to see it in 3D, and I was expecting a little bit more.
You saw it in 3D.
Yeah, but I did not. There was some moments where they either flattened or extended the depth to make certain moves look cooler that I appreciated. I don't think it's like necessarily worth paying for this Kung Fu Panda in 3D, but. More importantly, all of like the animation timings that I think the series has been really good at, when they decide to give up on physics in order to make something look cool or have a laugh, I think all of those are there. Like, there was definitely, I knew when things were cool were about to happen, and even the joke that was in the trailer where a sneeze goes down Poe's body and turns into a tiny fart. Like, it all works. I chuckled at the actual animation of it. So the craft is there. The story isn't this time for me.
I will say about the two dads that if you haven't seen Kung Fu Panda 3, where like the plot is kind of like Poe reconnecting with his like panda family and meets his biological father, you would absolutely assume that this is like a panda and goose couple that have raised this panda child together.
Yes.
There's like no explanation whatsoever in the text of the movie. And I kind of liked that. Like, I think the two of them together are fun, and maybe some conservative parents will get mad about it, and I will enjoy that part of it.
Yeah. Or just give them their own short TV series of them eventually getting to wherever Poe is, and let those two actors go at it. But don't put it in your movie.
Riley Davis presumably got a decent sized paycheck to play the chameleon. Awkwafina sure has done a lot of these kinds of roles, huh?
She has.
Yeah, I think it's time for her to not voice the wacky friend in an animated film.
Yeah.
Maybe there's more for her out there. I don't know what it is.
Chris Pratt, stop voicing characters from my childhood first. Then we could deal with the Awkwafina.
Yeah, which Mario character will Awkwafina play? Yeah. Mario recently announced Mario sequel.
Daisy.
The kids must be
obviously.
I would say Daisy, the superior Awkwafina as people on an unlikely partnership road trip animated movie is Raya and the Last Dragon.
Ooh.
Good movie.
Not good movie.
Okay, well, we can debate about that later. Kung Fu Panda 4 might be the best if you are under a certain age. So
if you were not born when Kung Fu Panda 3 came out.
And you are the target audience for that.
You could find it in theaters.
Katie, we were joking before the podcast, but the jokes become real on the podcast, which is, can you name an X-Man? Can you name a character from X-Men? Now, you play Marvel Snap, so you should have a little
leg
up.
It's been a while since I played Marvel Snap, but no, like, I mean, I saw the Matthew Vaughn X-Men enough, like, in the early years
of
this podcast.
Matthew Vaughn X-Men. Oh, right.
I mean, I saw the Bryan Singer ones.
Three more,
Yeah, but, like, you know, Professor X and Magneto and Cyclops and Mystique and Nightcrawler. What's the Olivia Munn bathing suit one?
Bathing suit woman.
Psylocke.
Familiar with her.
Keep going. This is fun.
Rogue.
This should be the mini segment. Rogue.
That's a good one.
What's Rogue's powers?
No, that's Storm controls the weather. What are Rogue's
that's right,
powers? Rogue's very powerful. It's like a mental thing. She can like control people's minds or something.
It is a very physical thing, unfortunately, for Rogue.
It's a touch.
Yeah. It kind of ruins her life.
She can't touch her.
Oh.
The men in her life.
Isn't who Sophie Turner plays in the really terrible one?
No, that's Jean Grey. This is Anna Paquin.
Oh, I'm confusing her with Jean Grey. Beast, I said Beast, who is Nicholas Holt in the J-Law ones.
Mm-hmm.
There's a guy who turns into a frog.
That's Nightcrawler.
There is a
toad
frog. Toad.
Okay. You guys looked at me like I was crazy.
That's because it's not the princess and the frog. It's not. He doesn't turn into a toad.
Okay. And Emma Frost.
He can crawl.
I'm gonna end it there.
Okay. You got it.
I just remembered that. The host of the Traders U.S. was Nightcrawler.
Uh-huh.
In the X-Men movie.
Everything goes back to
frog.
Traders.
Everything
also,
does.
You, need you to also detox, know she's man. Not pulling off of Marvel Snap knowledge because Emma Frost is just the White Queen in that game.
Yeah.
Well, I remember January Jones in her own version of a bathing suit. So the X-Men are not going to be part of the MCU anytime soon. So now all this drama is going on. Is that what's happening?
Oh, the X-Men will be part of the MCU this July.
Wolverine is literally in the Deadpool movie, Katie.
Oh, right, and that's now MCU.
Remember Wolverine?
Mm-hmm.
I do. Oh, yeah, I didn't name Wolverine. I am familiar with Wolverine. I've seen several of his films.
Logan?
I know him.
The Greatest Showman?
He is indeed the Greatest Showman. He's the father. No, he's the son, not the father.
The reason we were talking about the X-Men, but now I feel like this is almost enough that we've just done a segment here, but we wanted to talk about the X-Men because actually the X-Men are coming back. The X-Men, to your point, Katie, they're not really back in the MCU. I guess Wolverine is in the multiverse, and somehow this Deadpool movie will break things open, and they'll make their way into the important movies. But the X-Men is being revived in the strangest way. Like, I can't believe this is real, but Marvel, with their animation arm that's done What If, I think we've talked about that on the show before, has revived the 90s X-Men television show, the animated series called X-Men 97. It is a complete like nostalgia bomb pastiche of this show that Katie, did you watch the 90s animated X-Men show? Was that
my brother did sometimes, but we were just not really a superhero household. So I remember it existing.
The show is probably best known. I mean, it's the reason Bryan Singer wanted to direct an X-Men movie. It's the reason a lot of people know what the X-Men is. Dave, did you read X-Men comics before you actually watched the X-Men animated series, or were you also gateway drugged into?
They were sort of both. They were sort of both at the same time, because I got sucked up into the like X-Men number one collectors boom. But I either the show and the comics were happening simultaneously for me.
This show was just like so scrappy. There was no budget. There was no faith in kind of mature animated storytelling happening in the 90s. I spent a strange amount of time talking to the people who created this show over my years, Eric Seewald and his wife Julia, and a bunch of their animation writer friends, like, convinced Fox Entertainment, which desperately needed a hit in the animation space, to kind of straight up adapt comic books. It was very faithful to Chris Claremont books and other classic X-Men runs, and it was pretty mature for what it was in the 90s, and it premiered within a month or two of the Batman animated series, another kind of like major milestone moment for taking cartoons seriously in the US. The show petered out. Like, it kept losing its budget. The fourth season of the show is absolute trash from an animation standpoint. It all exists on Disney Plus if people wanted to go back, if you missed that window and never watched this series. But it's really how I learned what the X-Men were at all, and so many other people. And now Marvel has brought it back, and we're getting it later this month. I've seen some episodes, and it's surreal. It's uncanny X-Men, if you will. That's a little reference for Dave, because it's supposed to look like the trash animation of the 90s. They're kind of using the same technology from What If, so there's still this kind of like weird cel-shaded 3D side of the animation at times, but it's supposed to look like that classic 90s somewhat cheap animation look. And they got all the voice actors back, and they're still doing kind of newish but classic X-Men stories, and pushing the story forward. It takes place in 1997. Professor Xavier is dead. Like, there's continuity. It is such a strange exercise, and very, very targeted at a certain millennial viewer. I don't know
why
who
do you
this
think
will
it's
be
so,
for, but like,
why do you think it's so strange, given that this entire industry is predicated upon nostalgia and nostalgia plays, and this is a very,
very specific, like, what,
yeah, but
kind
it's,
of...
I think you might be, I mean, I haven't seen it, so I really can't speak to like how nostalgic core it is, but you might be underestimating just how popular and beloved the X-Men animated series was. This was not some niche program.
It was
this
huge.
Is something that I, who could not give a shit about any of this, watched every morning religiously before school. It's the only reason I know what like the Sentinels are and the Phoenix Saga and all that shit. And
and it's probably not that different from like reviving Night Court right now and reviving old sitcoms and trying to get the Gen X audience or the Boomer audience back watching television and repurposing IP that we thought was super disposable. I guess it does make sense. Because it's so pastiche driven that it's not just, hey, we're doing the X-Men as a cartoon again, but very specifically emulating like an old style of the cartoon, complete with the original theme song and a remastered version, basically, of the title, the credit sequence. I don't totally get.
This makes sense to me.
I don't know. I don't get it. But maybe it does make perfect sense.
This
why
is,
not
I mean,
push it forward?
This is the Disney Plus viewership.
Good. I enjoyed it. Yeah.
This is the Disney
Plus
viewership.
The original show was good, too.
It was good.
It's going to make me, almost 40-year-old male who has Disney Plus, but basically just goes there to Bluey, go to Disney Plus and watch it. This is what Disney needs.
I guess I'm just uncomfortable being pandered to. In this way, like, I don't want to feel this old.
You've gone
I don't
to
want to feel like I'm
of
part
work,
of revival
friend.
TV show?
Haven't you ever noticed that all the songs in car commercials are songs that you remember from when you were younger, because we're now the demographic that they're trying to get to prey on our nostalgia? It's all happening.
Yeah,
this is all happening.
Also, rock music died in the late 2000s.
Dave, what was your big X-Men question? What was you're excited for this show? That we should also note, we were talking about this before the podcast, that the guy who created the show or picked up the baton, the showrunner who's worked with Marvel on a bunch of stuff, what is his name, is Bo
DeMeo.
DeMeo has been fired unceremoniously from the show just like hours before we're recording, and days before the show premieres. And there's like a whole season two in the can, I guess. But this guy who is also writing on the Blade movie has just been fired for reasons completely unknown. Probably did a bad, we'll find out. But like, there's some weird controversy swirling. So we're recording this at a moment where we don't know exactly what's going on. But let's leave that to the side for a second and relish in the fact that we're getting an X-Men animated show that is good.
Yeah.
And Dave, you had a question.
Arcs. Does it look like they're doing arcs again?
It does. It does. There's like individual, they're not doing it. Some of the episode names have come out and they're not doing it in the classic animated
like
style.
One.
Being like part one, part two, part three, part four. But you know, when it's serialized, so I don't think I'm spoiling anything. Well, I'm going to spoil something that's in the trailer, I guess. But like Magneto has taken over the X-Men and everyone's pissed off. Scott Summers, Cyclops, he was supposed to be in charge. Also, Jean Grey is very pregnant. And they do a very good job of animating her pregnant, I found. Now I sound real old.
Yeah.
The guy who watched the X-Men animated show in the 90s absolutely loves that Jean Grey is pregnant and illustrated in a way that really feels like she's carrying child. That's what I care about now. There's continuity, but there's good action, and it is the X-Men animated show. I should get over my hesitation for buying in and just enjoy it, because it is exactly what it's supposed to be, and it's fun.
Yay!
As everyone knows, the most important event of the year, the event that we all structure our lives around and anticipate for months and talk about for months, I think, happened on Sunday, the Oscars. We're all like that, right? Like, we can all just name off the top of our heads who won in all of the categories.
This weekend with Daylight Savings, I was fucking clowned on by my stove. And almost missed it. If it didn't start late,
is that because your stove doesn't autocorrect?
Correct. I have to set that shit. Yeah. So the stove clowned on me, and if they hadn't had been delayed starting because of protests, I would have missed the opening.
You know, the 5-minute delay of protests, I appreciated, not only because I am extremely sympathetic to the nature of the protests, but also because I needed every possible second to get ready for this show that started an hour and a half, because it used to be 8:30 earlier than usual.
Oh, you're right. It would start at 8:30 sometimes.
Well, it started at 8, and then ABC would do their final 30 minutes of the rehearsal.
Fucking nightmare for me. I completely understand the move. I think it was probably smart and accounts for the marginal increase in ratings, which have nothing to do with the movies nominated, it turns out. I think some of us knew that.
Yeah.
But, because now you have the final hour in prime time and not in the dead of the night. But
it was over at 10:30. It was incredible.
Two very important things to say about this. One, fuck you, Patches. It should be illegal. It should be illegal, like to The Hague, to have the Oscars end at 10:30. Like, it is a crime against humanity.
No,
you want to be weary and you want to be like falling asleep.
The Oscars, if you're going to start at 7, the show needs to be 4 hours long. But this is a conversation. I'm assuming Katie's on my side here. My real bone to pick is that those of us with children who need to watch the Oscars for work, we're in a very, very difficult spot. Particularly me, who my son refuses to let anyone else put him to sleep. And so I just had to like tire him out all day long Sunday, kick out my family who was visiting. And then
why didn't he just stay up and watch the Oscars?
Because he wouldn't have really let me watch. I told him that there was an important show, but he passed out on my lap at about 7:02, face down.
Well done.
I kept my kid up for a while, and I was like, "That's Vanessa Hudgens. That's Julianne Hough."
Your kid is about 2 hours older than mine.
Care?
2 years older than mine, rather.
I got Charlie to watch the opening monologue with me, and then like the beginning of the supporting actress presentation. I was like, "They're going to give an award. Look, I can tell you who's going to win." And I lost him, and that was the end of that. David, I have been in that position of desperately trying to get the kids to bed before an award show starts. But I got to say, if your kids are old enough to at least tolerate one parent putting them to bed other than the other, which is where we've gotten, it was great. I love the Oscar starting at 7.
Well, yeah, because then in that situation, you get a night off of putting your kids to bed. It's just a win-win for you.
Uh-huh.
But, I was in the same position.
I am not in that
position. I had a martini. I was watching the Oscars. I was blogging.
I was typing up a storm. Okay, so here's the thing about the Oscars not being 4 hours long. I would agree with you, David. Like, I always hate it when the Oscars are like, we got to go. We got to rush. But the miracle of this year's Oscars is that they were a little shorter than they usually are. They came in under 3.5 hours and didn't feel rushed. It didn't feel like they were rushing people off stage or even trying to like fly through presentations. They did those long like tributes to all of the acting nominees with the previous winners, which I love.
We are going to fight about this in the war room.
I just didn't feel like that joke about
how long the Oscars were, but didn't have time to have clips. Didn't have time to have a Lifetime Achievement Award.
There were great clips. They did a great montage for the screenplay nominees. They showed excellent clips for those. They did clips for the Best Picture nominees all throughout the night. They did clips for sound.
That sound reel was great.
These were not clips, Katie. These were little montages. I'm talking about a clip from the film.
David, but how many times have you seen these movies? People watch your end of your movies.
My real point of contention with this, and this is my real point of contention with the way that they did this, was very simply that I felt as if having these people come up and say the same generic sentiments about how lovely these nominees were as people is, if I were one of those like woke police people, this would have driven me insane because it was all about virtue. It was all about who they are off screen. We are there to award who they are on screen.
Oh my God.
I don't give a shit. I don't give a shit how nice of a person you think Cillian Murphy is. He seems like a lovely guy. I'm just one example of many people. But I want them to talk about the performances, what you're sensibly there.
They did talk about the performances.
No, they didn't. It was really, it's a lovely idea.
What do you want more of? You want more of like the overly emotional, out of context clips where people are like, I'm crying here, I'm burning my eyes.
Watch the 2004 Oscars.
You don't actually get
how many
good clip of anyone acting.
Every clip from Mystic River in the 2004 Oscars will convince you that you don't want Oscar clips.
Katie, that shit is burned to my brain until the day I die.
Is that my daughter in there? Is it?
But I do feel like you need a visual representation in the movies, more so of it. I do think the Oscars continue to be ashamed of the movies, as you see from the jokes about how long they are and how no one saw this movie or that movie. But my bigger point of contention, because they did come back slightly around on the film footage. I don't know if we can call them clips, but on the film footage after the opening award, was just that I felt like the focus was not on the movies. It was on just like saying the same fucking, you know, vague platitudes about these people over and over and over
again. Some of them were that way, but some of them were really funny.
And then
it
was fun when
Nicolas
Cage
up there.
Right.
Christoph Waltz talking to Ryan Gosling was so strange. Like, it didn't make any sense to the point that it made perfect sense. Like, the Oscars are incredible because you get all these famous people in one room together. And I think those presentations give you that little bit of like, oh, Mary Steenburgen knows who Emily Blunt is. Okay.
Reminder that Mary Steenburgen has won an Oscar.
Sure.
And you probably wonder what did she win an Oscar for? Now I'm going to go look. Now, who are these
Melvin
people?
And
what
Howard.
Is this legacy?
You think Emily,
you know, like,
Mary Steenburgen doesn't know Emily Blunt is. She doesn't live in the moon.
They seem to have some kind of relationship. And I was like, I didn't know that. It gives all the nominees their moment. Like, it gives America Ferrera a chance to kind of like get emotional because Rita Moreno is talking directly to her and she doesn't win. Like, we all knew she wasn't going to win, but it lets all of the acting nominees have like a tiny spotlight.
I will say before Katie invited us to rain on her parade that thought that the show was definitely above par. I thought it was a fine Oscars. I agree with all of the nice things Katie said about it, that it moved and the bits worked well enough and so on. It always raises my hackles when they do things that that make them seem sort of ashamed of the movies or try
but
to
like
background
they
the
did
themselves.
So little and, of that and, this year. Like they and, there was, it was so light on it compared to other years.
And I'm bothered by, you know, as I said at the top of the segment, bothered by the fact that it was running so fast that they had to vamp with a Donald Trump. You know, I didn't mind that joke. I thought that was funny enough in context. But I'm just saying that, like, there was room for more. There was time to feed the people who give a shit And like, and the ratings not going up is further evidence, as we've talked about in the past, that you need to serve your core audience rather than trying to delude yourself.
I agree with that.
I didn't really feel like anything was missing. I still feel like the core audience for the Oscars, and I got a lot of what I wanted, and a lot of what I wanted this year was hearing people talk and give good speeches. I thought all the speeches were great, and that no one really got played off early. I was astonished that political statements were made and emotional tears were flooded.
No, let's talk about political statements. I think this is the place to work this out.
I was really moved by the ceremony for the Jews. Jonathan Glazer. I felt we could talk personally on this podcast, talk openly. I'm not certainly afraid. And our listeners have stuck around for long enough. Who gives a fuck? I felt very seen by Jonathan Glazer's brief comments as a Jew who has felt that my identity has been hijacked for years on end by the right wing people around the world and anyone.
We're gonna bring Ben Shapiro in here for a second.
Jesus. And so it was meaningful to me. You know, any sort of free Palestine comment or overture for a ceasefire, I would have appreciated. But his comments about my and our shared identity being hijacked for such catastrophic purposes really resonated with me and made me extremely happy, especially in the context of Zone of Interest, which is a movie that is impossible for divorce from that kind of conversation. And I think people are so eager to bury their heads in the sand. I was extremely disappointed that he was the only person who said anything of that sort. I know that grandstanding at the Oscars or at an award show hasn't always been the best look. But I think that
People grandstanded on different topics, maybe not the same
one. Well, Palestine flag pins. There were artists for ceasefire
but
pins.
I was disappointed, especially at the end of an award season. I mean, maybe naively.
You wanted more from the 20 Days of Mirapol guy.
I thought his speech was lovely and heartbreaking. But I am of the mind that particularly the end of the award season, I don't think these ultra famous people who have just won an Oscar
are—they're not running anymore.
I don't think they're really putting themselves in harm's way to speak truth to power, and call for the end of a genocide. I mean, like, this is just how I feel about this. But I understand.
What do you think about Cillian Murphy's?
He supports the peacemakers. Yeah.
And I think he meant that George Clooney movie. Because there's only one.
No, I would have, if I were scripting the show, I certainly would have, I would have put a few more meaningful words into a few other people's mouths, but I was very appreciative of Jonathan Glazer.
Speaking of speeches and the reason that the show went over is your boys Miyazaki and Wes Anderson didn't show, David. Yeah. That's the extra 5 minutes you're looking for.
The
right
two
there.
Wins that I was most excited about.
Can you imagine Miyazaki's speech? Had he bothered to be there, like he would just been like, "Thank you very much, goodbye."
Miyazaki is 82 years old, and I completely buy the excuse that he was just not interested in travel. But I do not think, someone who passed up the opportunity to accept his first Oscar for Spirited Away and boycotted the show because of America's involvement in the Iraq War. Mm. I don't think that was a non-factor in his decision not to come now.
Sure. But hitting him to Toronto for the premiere, like he's just been staying home.
I also saw they issued comment after, and I think there was even a translator there to read comment after.
I think the COO of Studio Ghibli was there.
I think one of the comments made was like, it's not his last movie.
Mm-hmm.
They keep saying shit like that. He's continuing to work, so they can't be like he's done. I mean, he literally goes to the office every day and works.
He and Martin Scorsese are in the same boat where they're like, yeah, man, put me in. I'm not done yet.
It's so much harder for, and this is funny considering how grueling the Killers of the Flower Moon shoot was. It's so much harder for Miyazaki to make a movie.
Yeah.
Yes, and Katie, you're absolutely right. He would have showed up and been like, thank you, and walked
off. I imagine Wes Anderson's speech also being fairly terse as well.
And Wes Anderson, I knew in advance
movie,
was,
right?
Yeah, he's in Berlin. They're making a movie.
David, I retweeted your tweet about Wes Anderson not showing up, and someone tweeted back, like, I like to imagine Miyazaki and Anderson clinking glasses on an island somewhere. I'm like, yeah. Mm-hmm. I like to imagine that too.
And Diane Warren, who I have been an outspoken, not hater, but eye roller of for so many years, as she's been stealing spots in this category from Mary Steenburgen, for example.
And other people
who deserve them. Today of all days, I reviewed a new documentary about her that premiered at South by Southwest. and it's not very good, but I sort of, she comes off well enough in it. You learn some interesting things about her. And I sort of reached the conclusion where I was like, you know, I'm glad that there are the Diane Warrens out there in the world. And then like 3 hours after that review publishes, what happens? But a story breaks about how when they didn't mention her name in the category, she like lost her fucking mind.
She rampaged up to the conductor of the Academy Orchestra.
Yeah, was like, and was apparently like demanding to speak to the Board of Governors, which is like, I think if you have them on speed dial already, lady, I mean
explains
why you've been nominated so much.
She's been in the club for a long
fire
time.
Fire inside. Did we talk about Flamin' Hot on the podcast? Did anyone catch the Cheeto movie?
She started running around the orchestra level, not to the orchestra itself, looking for Board of Governors to talk to.
I'm spreading misinformation. Yeah. I apologize to Diane Warren.
Did anyone see the Flamin' Hot movie? I did not.
No, I didn't.
David?
Either.
Oh, God, no.
Flamin' Hot? None of us saw the Flamin' Hot movie.
Nobody saw the Flamin' Hot
Baja
movie.
Baja Blast movie, you're next. I will see you.
Yeah.
Dave, Godzilla won an Oscar.
Yeah, it was pretty great.
Feel good?
Yeah.
Wait, Dave, can you talk Godzilla's. To me? Can you talk to me about your feelings about this? Because, like, I know, you know, I think we both really enjoyed Godzilla Minus One. I think you probably even more than I did. I was impressed by the special effects for its budget. With the proviso, you know, with the asterisk that who knows how they did it, you know, the labor practices involved, maybe not be something you want to emulate. But I was not impressed by the special effects themselves necessarily. They looked like they cost what they cost to my eyes. I was surprised. I say this as someone who spent weeks on end editing a few shots from that movie and studying every pixel against my will. I would have given this to the creator in a heartbeat. How did you feel about the win?
I understand why. I've been, you know, since 'Tis the Season, I've been watching the VFX breakdowns, and like I knew that the special effects were done sort of cheaply and in a very specific way of ordering the shots and getting them approved. But I didn't know they only had like 20 feet of boat. There's like zero real boats in the movie, I guess. And then the places that they had to do like water replacement, the fact that like the big scene where he actually goes into the city and starts messing things up, they had none of that city. They may have had maybe 50 feet of set. So it does look uncanny for some of it. But the amount that they did for the money they had actually is more impressive than the creator in terms of what they were capable of pulling off. But also for similar reasons.
The creator did so much. Right. I mean, the creator was able to look like a $250 million movie at a fraction of that price.
Yeah. And Godzilla did too, mostly because for Godzilla Minus One, the director is the visual effects supervisor. And for the creator, Gareth Edwards knew what was possible with the equipment that he had. I think the solution is, I also saw a weird comment on Reddit that is like, you know, I thought Guardians of the Galaxy 3 was like also great. Like, why did Godzilla win? And it's like, it's about like budget and also like how much you are able to do sort of like under one house, I think. Because like stuff like Guardians of the Galaxy 3, I'm sure like the supervisors and stuff did a great job. But it's very specific companies who are working on, like, the animal characters or the planets or all the stuff. So things like The Creator and Godzilla Minus One are just, like, there's one team and they got it done for cheaper than these people who are, like, farming out to different things.
Sure.
I think
I was very happy that it won, just because I was happy for them that a Godzilla movie won this award is really exciting.
They had those great shoes. They had Godzilla shoes on.
Yeah, they had the shoes. They had the little Godzilla statues. I mean, they were clearly over the moon to be there. I thought that was great. And it was also really wild, even after thinking about these parallels for so many months, that Godzilla won an award and then Oppenheimer immediately won another an award. And it was just crazy whiplash. But I didn't necessarily understand it.
Gareth Edwards is getting to direct the next movie in the Jurassic franchise. That's like his reward. I am very happy.
That's a reward?
I mean, if he wants it, yes. Like
more big dinosaurs.
I mean, if that's what he does really well and he wants to do it again, that's fine with me. But like, yeah, Godzilla has an Oscar. is very nice, especially for when we can eventually show other people Godzilla Minus One, because it's not going to be on PVOD for months, because it's got a clear...
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
Godzilla, it's got a clear Godzilla X Kong.
I want to point our listeners to... So every year for the visual effects, they do these presentations.
Like the Bake Off.
Yeah, and you can watch it. It's on YouTube. It's like an hour and 40 minutes. I watched the creator and Godzilla portions of it. And you can see why the Godzilla team won. When all the visual effects people are sitting in a theater watching these really excited, getting people like, we get to make a splash over here, and we're at the Academy Theater like screening our footage and talking about the process, and you get to see these glimpses of the making of the film. There's just more narrative. It's just more excitement to have something outside Hollywood happening here. I think it was pretty inevitable for them.
I guess that's how you get nominated, not how you win. The winners are voted on by the entire Academy.
Right. No, I'm just saying these presentations are important. Like they create
presentation gets you nominated, and I think it gets you like attention as being like, oh, this fun group of outsiders.
And it's really fun to watch the reels. Like,
yeah,
if you have 20 or 40 minutes to watch creator and Godzilla ones, I highly recommend it.
Anyway, legendary Toho come to a deal. The audience is smart enough to tell the difference between two Godzillas available at the same time.
I can't figure this out.
What other Oscar wins do you guys feel strongly about?
Speaking of Godzilla, I thought it was very cool that we had such an internationally diverse group of winners. It was the most international language films that have ever won before. And it speaks to this ongoing trend of the internationalization of the Oscars. I mean, you saw that obviously Parasite being the big one, but now you have Zone of Interest and Anatomy of Fall and the Best Picture nominees. Anatomy of Fall wins Best Screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
Katie, is that the first time a non-English language film has won Best Screenplay?
I do not think so, but I don't think it happens very often. I think that it is the first international film to get an editing nomination. Because it also got that, I think.
Parasite win Best Screenplay?
I think it did.
Yeah, so, okay. But
I think it's very rare.
Yes, Parasite did win Best Screenplay. Sure. And you see, like, I find that exciting because you go to a place like Cannes or you cover these, you know, it feels like a film from anywhere in the world can, you know, get over the, as Bong Joon-ho says, that half
one inch barrier,
and it's been shrinkage, it's cold, it's winter now, and it can succeed in Hollywood, and you have companies like A24 and Neon who are able to turn films like The Zone of Interest, which, you know, I saw at Cannes, and there was absolutely no part of my mind, even given the last few years, that I mean, there was Oscar talk around it immediately, but I was just like I can't see there being I was blown away, but I can't see there being an audience for this.
And they beat Oppenheimer for sound. What an incredible win.
Not only that, I mean, the awards factor, but it's made like over $20 million.
Yeah.
This is Glazer's highest grossing film ever. Yeah. And he made one where Scarlett Johansson plays a sexy alien.
Yeah.
That movie did not make a lot of money.
No, it did not.
Yeah, it's incredible. I don't even fully get why Zone of Interest has made so much money, because it is a very uncomfortable and difficult watch.
I mean, people want to watch interesting movies, and there's not a lot of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean
this
been,
like, I assume we
conversation
said it,
around it for months now. I mean, it was a thing to see.
When the nominees came out, I don't know if I said it on this show, but like, it's the best picture lineup we've had in at least a decade, to my mind. Like, it's like there were just really good movies, and like and some of them made $1 billion and some of them made less than that, but they all like found their audiences. It was very encouraging, the kind of diversity in just types of movies that you can get at the Oscars and get audiences to actually pay attention to them.
Montage about stunts, because we can't give them an award, but then also no other montages.
Listen, that segment did inspire me to remember that there's a screening of The Fall Guy this week and to email Universal about it.
People
so
say
it
it's pretty good. Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling had good presenter banter.
Yep. I think if I don't have that many notes, I mostly enjoyed myself watching the Oscars, but I would like a few more just random montages.
They put a montage on social media on Sunday of like all of the Best Picture nominees.
Yeah.
That like kind of had real David's top 25 vibes to it. It was really good. So that kind of scratched my montage itch a little bit.
Yeah, no, just maybe more of those, but sort of what David said at the beginning, just I'm not as angry about it, because I usually hate the Oscars, and this one I was just like, oh, look at that. I may not agree with all of these people that won, but I could definitely see why they won. Maybe I just always need to watch all the movies.
What should there have been a montage of based on all the movies that were nominated this year? Like, what they decided to prop up stunts, which it was infuriating to me that they announced that they were adding the casting category next year, and then they tried to, you know, brush stunts under the rug by doing a montage and not adding a category.
I think a stunts Oscar is going to happen. So I think that was a nod in that direction.
But it was also Fall Guy promotion, as David insinuated. I just wonder, like, what are we even, what do you want?
It was definitely a commercial for Fall Guy.
What do you want a montage of?
But that's, I mean, that also, you know, more and more, especially with the ratings dipping, I feel like the easiest
ratings are
fix,
up slightly,
right,
not
but,
dipping.
You know, they're half what they were the year that 12 Years a Slave won Best Picture.
Sure,
but the best thing to do would be to make this the year's premier event for unveiling movie trailers, and because you have the most dedicated audience,
David wants
home.
It to be the Game
and
Awards.
We did get well, no, but I mean, I think in the commercials, not necessarily during the show. I mean, I think like make the commercials as exciting as the Super Bowl commercials are, which movie fans watch to see movie trailers.
But there were rules against that, right? For a long time.
What's that?
You weren't. There are rules against advertising.
Yes, there are, and I think there's some weird Disney shenanigans going on, because it did seem like a lot of the.
There was an Inside Out 2 trailer this year, and last year there was a Little Mermaid trailer. But
I remember that the Little Mermaid trailer introduced on stage at the Oscars. I remember that. That was
not cool. But yeah, I mean, I think like, rather than having, you know, the Fall Guy have like a subliminal ad where I don't believe the Fall Guy was ever mentioned, have a trailer, the world premiere of the trailer for the Fall Guy, you know, a commercial, and have a best.
You know what they need to do? Taylor Swift needs to date the Golden Oscar Man, and the Golden Oscar Man needs to be her new boyfriend for like the whole awards season.
Taylor Swift dating jokes are very topical and in.
And what the hell?
Season.
Don't ruin my gag. God damn.
Taylor Swift went to Madonna's Oscar party, but not the Vanity Fair party, and I'm mad about it.
Madonna has an Oscar party? Does she routinely have one?
Very secret. Guy Osiris' house, her manager.
Does Elton John still have one?
Elton John still has one. Jay-Z and Beyonce have one. Everybody's trying to
Why do you think Madonna
in.
Loves the Oscars so much?
Great question, because all of the famous people are in town. I have a question for David as a member of the Lily Gladstone Hive. I feel pretty sanguine about Lily Gladstone coming back and, you know, having her moment. She's already getting cast in big stuff. I was rooting for her. I like Poor Things enough.
Big
and I think
stuff
Emma
like
Stone.
What is
she's
Lily Gladstone?
She's
going to
be in that adaptation of The Memory Police that Charlie Kaufman's writing.
But that Reed Morano is directing, which makes me nervous, but. We'll
anyway, like it's I feel good about her chances of having a good career from here. But David, how are you feeling?
I mean, as Dave was saying earlier, like, you can't argue with the quality of the winners. I thought Emma Stone was just phenomenal in Poor Things.
Yeah.
And even if my personal bias was towards Lily Gladstone winning this award, it's not as if like The Blind Side won, you know? so I really can't be too mad. I think that the only way to move forward from this is to not treat Lily Gladstone the way that a lot of actresses in her position have been treated in the past, which is just like write her off as a one-off who had this great role and, you know, reduce her to the margins. I think, like, as Katie was just saying, like, the industry should remain open and continue to, continue casting people like Lily, like anyone in all these leading roles used to be exclusively reserved for, you know, white women of a certain look, and more opportunities to win an Oscar will naturally come her way because she's very talented. So as things, you know, the onus is on the industry as a whole rather than just this one trophy.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, like, and, you know, 'twas ever thus, but and I think that, you know, It was a great award season for her, regardless, but would have been nice. But, you know, hopefully there'll be other chances.
Yeah,
it's cool that Emma Stone produced her own movie that won her
an Oscar.
I mean, Emma Stone has an incredible, Frances McDormand did it for Nomadland. She was the first person to ever win Best Actress and Best Picture in the same year.
Emma Stone is making incredible, risky movies possible
with what she's doing. Like, it's a pretty great use of star power. Like, now that she has the second Oscar, like, I think we could go back and be like, eh, give her La La Land Oscar to Ruth Negga or something. But she's used that capital in really interesting ways. Yeah, it's not like nobody lost to Brendan Fraser or Rami Malek this year. Like, there's nothing to be mad about on that level.
No, and Emma Stone is like, just a second what Katie was saying. Like, she's like a unicorn. I mean, like, she almost exclusively does interesting things with the occasional, I mean, even Cruella, which is not particularly good, was kind of
Zombieland kind of double
interesting
tap.
For, yeah, the Zombieland double tap, I think she was sort of duty bound to do. She played
got an Ari Aster movie coming
in the Croods, A New Age, you know, she does these things. She never really sells out. She never, after the Spider-Man, the Amazing Spider-Man 2, like, never doubled back in the superhero machinery. She produces these films. You know, her alliance with Yorgos Lanthimos has obviously paid huge dividends, and maybe now she'll have one with Ari Aster.
Did you see their silent film that played at New York Film Festival, David?
Oh. I wanted to.
They also have another movie in the can. Isn't that right? There's like...
Yeah, Kinds of Kindness.
Follow-up to Poor Things.
Yeah, we'll hopefully be at can. It'll hopefully be at can. But she... yeah, I mean, I think she's a fascinating... I mean, The Curse was so interesting and brave in its way, even. And the fact that she, as was commented upon on X, the fact that she won this Oscar over Lily Gladstone has such uncanny resonances with her character on The Curse. I love Emma Stone, and I think she is sort of a force for good. She produced I Saw the TV Glow, her company did. They produced Problemista. They produced Jesse Eisenberg's When You Finish Saving the World, as well as his new movie, A Real Pain.
He's making movies.
Yeah, Margot Robbie is you know, operating in a similar vein with Chappie. Or is there a company called Chappie? It's kind of,
Chappie?
It sounds wrong. What's Margot Robbie's company
Lucky
called?
Lucky Chap.
Lucky Chap.
She teamed with Chappie? That's what Chappie did after the movie Chappie?
Yeah.
He started a company with Margot Robbie?
You're going to see him on stage accepting Best Picture any one of these years.
Chappie!
But yeah, really cool to see these actresses, you know, becoming so much more and wielding their power in interesting ways.
Chappie.
I don't know. Did anything suck?
Charlotte Copley is in a new movie this year?
I mean,
I was just going to talk about how good Ryan Gosling was, but I mean, I know everyone's
already talked
about that.
They really nailed that.
I'm wearing my Kenergy, my Knuff sweatshirt in honor of how great Ryan Gosling was. What a wonderful thing to have gotten to witness.
The best part wasn't even when he was on stage dancing and doing a big throwback musical moment. It's when he was in the seats next to Margot Robbie making her cackle.
Yeah.
Because she was just so happy to be there, and he was... living.
How about the video of Martin Scorsese watching the whole thing and grinning his way through it also?
0 out of 10.
And also
Scorsese.
Just like, I know, you know, Ryan Gosling was forged in the fires of the Mickey Mouse Club.
Mm-hmm.
But,
to do this. It was all leading to this moment.
But he sounded so good. I was watching like Josephine Decker on her Instagram, the Madeline director. Among other things, posted from the top decks of the Dolby Theater, just a video that she took, and watching how small that performance was in person relative to what it seemed like on TV, just kind of made it more impressive in a way. The spectacle that they were able to create around him, and just like how the energy that he brought to the camera in front of him. What a cool moment. I mean, but another way they cut down on time was shearing all the song nominees, and this is not a complaint in you know, when it comes to the song from Flamin' Hot, but even I'm Just Ken was cut down to less than half of its runtime, or as it is on record, or even as it is in the movie. And man, could have gone
but you can't do the
that.
Full like there's
know,
a lot of
I
there's
know.
A lot of
yeah,
silence and I'm just not
missing.
Silence but like lack
know,
of
I
lyrics
and it was Justin Chang, I believe, who was writing The New Yorker about how it was perfect because it didn't go a second longer. It may have tipped over into Kennervation, but didn't. yeah, so cool. Miyazaki won another Oscar. So cool. Beat The Amazing Spider-Man.
Nolan has an Oscar.
Nolan has an Oscar.
Here's my question. What do you think Nolan's going to do next?
Well, he's apparently writing his next script.
I saw, like, I saw TSR being like, some people think it's this thing he invented in 2009. Some people think it's new. I'm like, ah, nobody knows. Nobody knows what he's going to do next. Sorry, what, like, do you, what you think
what
you do?
What genre's left? I feel like he's going to do a Western. Once you win your Oscar and you have unlimited possibilities, you cash out and you do the genre no one wants to make, and he's going to do a big Western. That's my guess.
I mean,
after Horizon Part 1, 2, 3, and 4 come out, everyone's going to be hungry for a good old-fashioned...
You inflated that by 2, right? Are there really 4 Horizons?
Well, there's 2 in the can and 2 imagined on paper.
Oh, great.
That you have imagined or Kevin Costner has imagined?
That Kevin Costner... This is a 4-part saga.
Lord.
The Horizon American saga is 4 parts. We're
you
getting
know what?
2 okay.
I was
going to
see it because I was curious, but knowing I'm
money,
voting
though.
With my money, I'm not going to fucking wait till it comes streaming.
Horizon?
I'm for some reason a Western does not seem right for Christopher Nolan, and I can't say why because he makes movies about like men coping with deep responsibility.
It's the wrong
and,
kind
like,
of coat. He likes a certain kind of coat, and it wouldn't be the right weather.
Yeah,
I don't necessarily see that. There are rumors that he wants to make a because he was working on this more than 10 years ago now, a remake of The Prisoner.
That's the thing they were saying.
I mean, there've been grumblings about him wanting to make a horror movie. You know, I think the reality is that he has been in a position to make literally anything he wants for a very long time
Pretty
now.
Cool.
And I don't think there is really all that much additional capital, even after the wild Oscar winning success of Oppenheimer that he didn't have before.
I really like David's tweet about Tenet as the Oscar follow up that he made in reverse. It was a good joke, David.
Great tweets.
Well, thank you.
You've been citing 2 tweets
I know.
Get off
Sorry.
Twitter.
Wait, what were you going to say? You think that you wanted him to make?
What did I want Christopher Nolan to make?
I thought I interrupted you saying you wanted him to make something else.
Oh, I have no idea anymore. I want Christopher Nolan to. I just said, like, if he
Avengers,
if he has an Oscar
Secret
now,
Wars.
He can make the most boring movie possible.
Avengers.
I think he was allowed to do anything.
I don't think he can make a boring movie.
The narrative around Oppenheimer was like,
if he made
really
an Oppenheimer that was all Robert Downey Jr. scenes, like an Oreo, you know. Yeah, I don't know. He'll do whatever the fuck he wants. It'll come out in 3 years, like they always do.
Mm-hmm.
It'll come out in the middle of July, and it'll make $1 billion. It'd be great. I don't know. What do you want from me?
It's interesting to me about Oppenheimer is I compared it to someone talking. I think it's going to be a lot like Titanic in that it is this huge Oscar-winning hit that nobody really replicates, that there's like no tail on either of these movies. They're so distinctive to the people who made them and to the time that they came out that you can't like make another one. No studio is going to be like, well, if we release our big biopic in the summer, we can pull another Oppenheimer. And I love that about it. That's what's so special about Christopher Nolan and the place he occupies in pop culture right now.
The
I
Oscars.
Wish more people had that opportunity. I stand with Cord Jefferson.
Of course. I want more people to be able to make movies. I just don't think anyone's going to be like, if we do our 3-hour biopic and release it in July, it'll win Best Picture again.
Even Nolan knows this, which is more people should have the opportunity that he has. More people should be able to become Christopher Nolan, and you don't get there automatically, you know, directing a $100 million 3-hour biopic or something. You have
here's
to
my question
get
to
the
you guys.
Little chances.
You have to get the subscription to the generative AI video app,
<That's>
and
right.
then
do
you
think,
have to write your thoughts into it and cut
do
those
you
together.
Think this will be Chris Nolan's last Best Picture Oscar.
Yeah.
No. He's not an old man.
No, but I think that the Oscar trend has been away from like people who we know and like already. Like Scorsese's never going to win another Best Picture Oscar. I'm not sure Spielberg will. Like,
I think he has too many more movies.
I think like they have been more into like international people who they haven't given it to before or brand new voices. So like Oscar trends change all the time, but I think it's going to be very hard to win a repeat Oscar, especially if you are like a pretty established, like very powerful white guy in Hollywood. That just doesn't seem to be the kinds of movies that
like,
capture momentum to
get
you
Best
Picture.
Does he make prestige films? Like, this was an interesting
I don't think it's as
play
much about
him.
That. It's about like heart and like a narrative and excitement and a sense that you are like putting your stamp on something that's thrilling. And Oppenheimer was
but
kind
if it's
of 40 inevitable.
40 years from now, who knows?
I don't
and
know.
We won't have
like 40 years
that.
From now, sure. I mean, he'll
be
like
he'll
90.
Write another
like,
movie with his brother, and it'll be about time and something else, and we'll you know
we'll
go
that.
On. We'll
I
go
think
on
it would be very unlikely. Who was even the last director? I guess Spielberg. No, Saving Private Ryan. Who was even the last director to have 2 Best Picture winners?
Well, let's see. Best picture winner.
I mean,
Alejandro Gonzalez Iñárritu, of course.
The Russo brothers. Oh.
Wait, no. The Revenant didn't win best picture.
Oh, well.
Best director. There's been Cuarón.
Let's see.
Cherry?
And Ang Lee all won best picture twice. Won best director, twice.
Yeah.
Ben Affleck's won it twice.
Best picture? No, he hasn't.
I kid.
I don't think it's William Wyler has done it.
Oh, it's Clint Eastwood for Million Dollar Baby.
Yeah, there you go, Clint Eastwood.
And what was his last? Unforgiven.
Yeah, I mean, and that was like 13 years apart. And I think it will become even rarer given the way the Academy is changing for all the ways that we're talking about that are for good. It's hard to be in the
club.
He'd
have to dramatically reinvent himself. And I think that.
And I don't
think,
why
would
he?
Eastwood doing a big Western and then years later doing like a tiny boxing drama. That's pretty different.
I don't want a tiny boxing drama from Christopher Nolan.
I don't want him to reinvent himself. No, so,
Christopher Nolan
right.
has said that he has no interest in doing small movies. So
yeah,
I don't think he should. Yeah,
I think it will be his only Best Picture winner, and I think that's completely fine.
Can I have a way of wrapping up this segment? I've been thinking about it since we started talking. Mary Steenburgen,
mm-hmm.
the
Emily
Queen,
Blunt,
mm-hmm. love her.
Emily Blunt, 6 degrees. Who can get there?
Oh.
Connect Mary Steenburgen, Emily Blunt.
I'm terrible at this game.
Come on. You're terrible at this game?
Yeah, I can never remember who was in what.
What did she win her Oscar for, Kate?
She won her Oscar for Melvin and Howard.
That's a tough one.
I don't really remember who else is in that movie because I've never seen it.
She's in Back to the Future.
She is in Back to the
Mary Steenburgen.
She's in Back to the Future with Michael J. Fox.
You can surely get there in one step from Step Brothers.
Yeah,
Mars Attacks. She was in Step Brothers with Richard Jenkins.
Oh, she's
Will Ferrell, John C. Reilly. Surely one of those three people has been in a movie with Emily Blunt.
Richard Jenkins should have been in Oppenheimer, but it's not. His real
John
I was
C. Reilly
Oppenheimer vibe.
And Will Ferrell have definitely been in movies with Matt Damon at some point.
Well, Emily Blunt was in The Adjustment Bureau with Matt Damon, but that just gets you right around the same place.
Well, that's only two steps. I mean, there you go.
Well, remember, Natalie Portman's in Mars Attacks. She's a good link to.
We've already gotten there.
Is this how you wanted to wrap up this segment?
The Oscars, baby.
Here's how we wrap it up. To my eyes, this segment's over.
Wow.
No, my
eyes
see this.
My
segment.
Eyes see us closing the show.
That does it for this week's show. We'll be back next week talking about Girls 5 Eva. We decided to do this a couple weeks ago.
Girls 5 Eva.
Girls 5, gonna be famous together.
David, yep. Are you Girls 5 Eva?
No, I'm not watching that.
Save the clip. Wow, spoilers David. For next week is David is not going to watch the David thing we agreed to talk
about.
I hear it's
great. I just like, I don't have time.
You do. We're going to make it big time. Anyway, in the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches, executive editor at Polygon. I'm on Blue Sky and Letterboxd at Mr. Patches. We have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can go back and listen to old Gapton about Oscars, go back to last March, go to previous March, all the Marches, or maybe February's. What's the latest? What's the earliest the Oscars have been, Katie, in the modern times? Has it ever been in February?
In modern times? Oh, February. Yeah, it was in February in 2020. March? That's why it happened before the pandemic.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so don't make sure you don't look at March 2020 for our Oscar episode. Go to February.
Yep.
Anyway, fightinginthewarroom.com.
I'm David Ehrlich. I am a critic over at IndieWire. You can find me on X, David Ehrlich, and Blue Sky, and Instagram, and Letterboxd, and all that jazz. Not Facebook. I get texts every morning that it's somebody's birthday and I should wish them happy birthday, but I don't even have the information I need to log into my Facebook. People try to hack it all the time. They can't get into it. Nobody
wow.
needs my Facebook. Anyway, so don't find me there. But you can find all of us together on the Apple Podcast app at Fighting in the War Room. Leave us a review. We'll read it live on the show. Didn't do it this week, unless you guys are waiting to record it.
Oh, we did.
We did it this week.
Okay.
Well, I wasn't there for this week. Thank you, Asa. But the rest of you were. And you know how it works. You can also email us. Dave, where can they do that?
At fitwr.podcast@gmail.com. I'm Dave Gonzalez. That's D-A-7-E. You could find me there on Twitter and Blue Sky, and why would you? You can also listen to me talk on the Trial by Content podcast about other media things, and yeah, it's I'm psyched to check out what I'm now learning is 3 seasons of Girls 5 Eva. All right, let's do it.
I really think if you started on the 3rd season, you'd be fine. That's my professional opinion, but we'll see. I am Katie Rich. You can find me at Vanity Fair on Little Gold Men talking about the Oscars in a lot more detail, although we got into a lot, so maybe not that much more detail. Find me on Twitter and on Letterboxd, and I think that's it, at Katie Rich. I have an Instagram that's getting livelier. It's called Katie Rich Talking. We're all on Twitter and Blue Sky some at FITWR, where you can tell us your Oscar hot takes, or you can answer this week's lightning round question, which was:
in honor of Love Lies Bleeding in theaters this weekend, what's the worst cinematic way to get pulled into a life of crime or espionage?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.
No, I'm done. We're done.